we are a part of that collection of two white men doing podcasts. We're two queer white men. Does that differentiate us at all?
Or does it?
It totally helps with the topic.
We're talking about
musicals.
And we're talking about musical theater.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Nathan.
And yes, musical theater has gospel.
And dancing boys.
And fancy hats.
So join us for the Gospel of Musical Theater, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Dave,
can we please pick this up in 20 minutes? I feel like we're just getting started.
Let's pick it up in 20 minutes.
I'll come right back here.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It's me, Eric Williams, and yes, MTV legend Dave Holmes is on the podcast this week, and fook, are we lucky. As you heard in that teaser clip, Dave had a hard out at the end of the interview, but decided to come back and record with me longer after he had a work thing, and it's just a testament to this special conversation, it really is. If you follow me on Instagram, you saw that I was stuck in Portland for my day job because they got the most snow since World War II. Fun! Not only did that happen, but it was happening in real time as I was in a lift to the airport, and then we got into our car accident. I'm fine. The driver was fine. The other car was fine. But my driver said, quote, "No one knows how to drive in the snow here," moments before we were T-boned.
I do think it was partly my driver's fault.
She was really heavy on that pedal, girlies. I do want to say that once I realized I was stuck in Portland, I did what any normal person would do, which is continue to do the job that they are paid to do, but also get blazed and sit in the Holiday Inn Express's hot tub in my underwear. Do not have a staph infection, as one of my followers DM'd me I would get, which really added to my list of intrusive thoughts, but I do know they were just looking out for me, and hashtag no regrets. Let's get into this episode with Dave Holmes. You listen to his podcast with Matt McConkie that I got to guest on called Homophilia. He is also the editor-at-large of Esquire magazine, and off the record, Dave told me of a delicious celebrity that he just interviewed for a cover story, which I'm sure that you'll be seeing soon. So if you like this episode, follow along at Gay Ass Podcast. Of course, you have to hit the subscribe button on whatever platform you choose, and thank you for those great reviews. If you want to leave a 5-star review, don't know what to write, just write this: slay, binge, keep it coming, c-u-m-m-i-n-g. I love you so much. Let's fucking do it. Dave Holmes is on That's a Gay Ass Gosh Darn Podcast. I'm not gonna minimize what today is to me. It's big, and
my dog agrees.
And your dog agrees. I'm thrilled you're here. Dave, thank you for coming on this podcast. It means the world.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I've been so excited about this. And I will just give you a heads up. We're in Los Angeles. We're in weather-ravaged Los Angeles. We had some tree issues. Got a tree halfway down in our yard.
No.
So there are people sawing limbs off now. We could lose power and Wi-Fi at any second.
I love that we're on the edge recording this episode.
Right on the razor's edge.
Of the LA natural disaster.
And there's strangers in the yard, so, you know, my dog is reacting. I'm going to close the door. It'll help a little.
Sure.
Oh, Jesus.
The most important question is, are any of the people working in your yard attractive?
You know, I have not had a chance to get out and look.
And listen, you have a lot on your list today, and I know it's going to be towards the top, but you'll have to report back.
Yeah, here's the thing. Like, some people from the city came yesterday, I guess it was, to, like, you know, take, because there was a huge branch just, like, sitting on a power line. So they had to come over. I was not here when it happened, but my partner was like, four city workers are here and each one is hotter than the last.
Oh my God.
And I was really bummed that I missed it.
That's like almost overwhelming when you think about the porn video that could emerge from that situation, because
absolutely,
four on one while appetizing, there aren't enough holes.
No. But I mean, you know, so that's when you get crafty. That's when you get creative.
Crafty,
that's
creative, and bring in Rian Fagments. I do want to shout out why I'm so happy you're here, not only because when I did your podcast, Olive, it feels like a year ago. I think it was just a few months ago, but
it was like
maybe two months ago, a lifetime. But you emailed me that we were both in New York at the same time, and you remembered from our conversation that I had met my husband I had my first kiss with my husband at Art Bar, and you walked by and thought of me. That is so, you're one of the greats, and I just want to tell you that meant a lot.
It's the truth. That place, you know, has special significance.
It does. How was your trip to New York?
It was fantastic. It was really, really good. I went for a quick work thing that turned into a very long work thing. Right. And so it was fun. I was a little bit stranded there for about a week.
What part of town did you stay in?
It was great. Well, okay. So I did one night at a new hotel called the Aman in Midtown on 57th Street, right across from Bergdorf's. It's like this insane luxury hotel. And we're doing a hotel feature in Esquire. And so I wanted to stay there and, you know, see if we could include it in the feature and stuff. And so I got a night there in just like outrageous luxury. Such a great room.
So I'm assuming you're telling me this because it is on the list.
It's on the list for sure. Yeah, no, it'll definitely make the list. Like it was fantastic. And then the rest of the time I was at the Arlo, which is just, you know, one of those places that's fine. But like you get into your room and you're just like, oh, God damn, this is so small. And there's just no room for anything.
I mean, that's also, I feel like, a New York hotel through and through, which is like
a devastating
postage stamp. But I have to say that one of my life goals is to have the experience on the reg, like you had at your across the street from Bergdorf luxury hotel. All I want is just like a slutty tub.
Oh, this was the sluttiest tub ever. Mm. Bath salts all in there. Japanese toilet.
Of course.
With heated seat.
Of course.
Bidet. Like, I might be a bidet person now. I was a believer at the end of that 24 hours.
Listen to me. You are a bidet person. You were born a bidet person. You will die a bidet person. It's just you're learning it right now. I have seen the light as of a year ago. And every time I travel and there's no bidet, I have to schedule extra therapy sessions because it really drags me down.
Well, the thing is, it's the warming of the water that is critical. I had tried them before, but it was, you know, your typical non-heated situation, and that's alarming. I guess he would maybe get used to it, but this was like there was warm water. There was like an air drying option. It was just like,
oh my God, okay.
What is happening? Now I resent, you know, regular toilets, but we're not here to talk about
and we're
toilets.
Not here to talk about cold jets of water spewing into my open holes. We are here to talk about Dave Holmes's brilliance, Dave Holmes's St. Louis upbringing, Dave Holmes's gayness.
Yes.
I only because it's one of the most exciting things I'm most excited to talk to you about. You famously have a career that spans emotionally millennia. However, one part of your career that I love to go back into was your appearance on Watch What Happens Live.
Yes.
Where you were forced by also gay St. Louis and Andy Cohen to see where gay guys stand on all things Bravo. Mm-hmm. Now, we all should know, and if we don't, I'll teach the children now, that you went 8 for 8 in knowing where gay guys stand. And one of those things that you knew was Ryan Serhant versus Captain Lee, who was the hottest daddy. And you said what?
I think I said Ryan.
Ryan Serhant.
Yeah.
Do you have any hot takes about your relationship with Andy Cohen over the years, both being power gays from St. Louis, Missouri?
Oh man, please. We're both gays from St. Louis, Missouri. He holds a great deal of power that I do not. He's always been just a really lovely guy. You know, I mean, we do have, as you and I have, that common St. Louis suburban young gay boy, you know, background. He's always been like super supportive and cool, and yeah, I was on Watch What Happens Live because I did a Bravo panel show about Bravo shows in, I guess it was 2018 or 19, and so we were promoting that. Mm. Yeah, we did. It was a 3-episode test run. We did not get picked up after that, and that was that. But it was a fun experience.
So there was a panel show about Bravo. Was it you, like, mm-hmm. with, were there guests of the shows or other pop culture commentators? Who was it?
There would have been had we gone any further. Sure. I think Kelly Ripa was a guest once. Yeah. There was maybe a housewife or two. Maybe a Kelly Dodd called in.
I mean, rest in power. Jeez.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was me, Jerry O'Connell, a comedian named Michael Yo, and Brendan Schaub, who is who's like a UFC guy, or I don't know, he's a fighter of some kind, but also kind of steeped in the Bravo world, and he's got a big podcast and whatever. So it was the four of us. It was originally it was supposed to be like a Sports Center about Bravo shows, and I was the one gay person on it, and also I'll just say it, the one person who does not watch Bravo shows.
I was curious about your relation to watching the shows.
Yeah. The executive producer of it, who's also the EP of Watch What Happens Live, is an old friend of mine from MTV. And she called me in for it. And I was like, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not like the biggest Bravo guy in the world. And she was like, it really ultimately doesn't matter. You don't need to be a big fan. You just need to be able to make jokes about it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, that I can do. So I like caught up on a couple shows and I, you know, tried to come up with some fresh observations and whatever, and I ended up getting the show. So then, like, between getting it and filming it was this insane month of just, like, cramming as much as I possibly could. And they're still largely not for me. Now I've turned my back on it entirely because the show didn't get picked up, and I'm bitter, and I need, you know, I can't
stick it to up, Dave. Don't right. dare give them any of your attention.
Yeah, ultimately, it's, you know, I don't like it when people are mean to each other on television. It makes me sad.
Listen, there's been a lot of talk right now about the state of affairs with the Housewives because, as you might know, New York is not. We don't know what's happening with that. There's just. I'm gonna not disagree with you, and I will say that right now there's fear in the air for us Bravo watchers, but I think that the fact that you aren't a huge Bravo person and you went on Watch What Happens Live and you were able to please all the Bravo fans, that says a lot because similar to Drag Race fans, there will be blood.
Absolutely.
Andy did ask you about interviewing Britney Spears, and I'm obsessed with your story that you knew that she was like on the rise and she couldn't say anything controversial. So you said she was like, she had like a shock collar on.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it was, yeah, she was so heavily media coached. And like, you know, you think about the pressure that she was under and the many, many people who depended on her to like just not fuck anything up.
Yeah.
You know, at the center of just this like hurricane of label people and PR people and
mom and dad
stylists and mom and dad. And all that. And it's like, and it's just, it's essentially like there are a million rakes to step on. You know, there are a million banana peels to step on. She could have fucked it up in any of a number of different ways. It's like, you know, doing that kind of thing is hard to do well, but very easy to do poorly.
Oh, yeah.
She did really well.
And it's no, you know? I mean, it's kind of no wonder that things are where they are right now. And in fact, I don't know if this is controversial, but I think things, obviously she's going through a lot for very valid reasons, but I'm sure it could have been a whole lot worse. Like she,
sure.
The amount of pressure and money.
Yeah.
That was on her, is on her shoulders, is fucked oop. I aspire to be a successful person that goes to luxury hotels. I do not aspire to have Britney Spears pressure.
No, I mean, it is to be in the public eye at all is really disruptive and destabilizing and crazy. Like, being at MTV, I got like a tiny fraction of like notoriety mm-hmm. or whatever. And like once or twice, I was in, I myself was like not a thing in Page Six, but they mentioned me at it, like in a story about somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. And I, and like, even just the thing of like, I wasn't there last night or like, you know, just dumb little things. Page Six did not care about me. The readers of Page Six did not care about me. That is totally fine. And I knew that, but it was like just the fact of like, oh, they can kind of just say whatever they want about you. And then it's out there in the world. That's very weird.
Yeah, especially when like you have to defend yourself. Of course, whatever was in Page Six about you, I'm sure wasn't like, and Dave Holmes was throwing up on Colin Farrell. But I'm sure there are people who have things that go out in the media, in whatever newspaper or whatever it is, that are probably blatant lies that when you start to defend yourself, it's so hard. You know, I talked about this recently, that Allison Williams, when she was on Girls, mm-hmm. people thought that she was Marnie in real life, that that's how she acted. And she said at first that it really annoyed her to know that people thought that way. But once she got rid of the caring that like people were going to believe what they're going to believe, she was able to live her day-to-day life and not in ways that didn't have that weight. But like, I can imagine that if you are bringing it back to the Real Housewives, there are so many fucking fake things that go around to drum up controversy that like, I'm sure at some point it's like the boy who called wolf, which is that you want to defend yourself, but you're worried that no one's going to believe you.
Exactly. And like, and those people, as I was, are like adults, like full adults who knew what they were jumping into. And if you're a kid and you're just trying to like, you just want to put on a show, or you just want to please mom and dad or whatever. And then this whole other thing comes. And then, you know, on top of it, everyone's talking about your body as it's changing. Ugh. Like it really could and probably should have been a lot worse. Even, you know, taking into account this latest video where she's Australian.
Well, you know, it's,
she's
just showing her.
Don't be a roller coaster.
It's a roller coaster. But I have been wondering, when you were doing like the competition to be like the next VJ, how old mm-hmm. were you in that process?
27.
Okay, so young. And you
ish.
I mean, well, here, actually, I think 27, I was wondering it for a few reasons, but one, I think that it's young, but it's also, the good news is you're not a child, that obviously you could handle the pressure because you did so well. But I think that one of my favorite clips of yours that I remember watching a long time ago, but also I was resurfaced recently, Arnold Schwarzenegger is on MTV and you're asking him what he thinks about Mandy Moore, and she's in the background, sort of going, I'm missing you like candy, and he just keeps going, sexy, 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 and you keep interjecting 15 mm-hmm. she's 15.
She's a child.
So do you, I'm assuming you remember this moment pretty vividly?
Only because it was on my reel for a while. I'm telling you, like, more and more people are like digitizing old VHS tapes or whatever. And so like things will resurface on YouTube. And when that happens, everyone like tags me on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I'll watch it and like, I never remember what it is. It's all, everything happened so fast and was so utterly surreal that like, I was not able to form cohesive memories of any of it.
Sure.
It's crazy.
Well, it's probably like, it's not that you're like blacking out due to trauma. It's almost that you're like, you're just, it's probably adrenaline and.
Yeah. It's not like that. You know what I mean? Like it is, it's definitely like you're in an unfamiliar space and you're like, adrenaline is rushing and yeah, I mean, it is a little like a
trauma response.
Yeah. I mean, it's a joyful trauma.
Yeah.
But it's unusual.
Well,
it's
not, part of the reason why I'm curious about your age then is because it's such a heightened experience. But I feel like at 27, you bring more of a presence, like being present, mm-hmm. than probably any younger than that, because when I was watching You and Watch What Happens Live, Rory O'Malley is the bartender, and he, of course, famously was Elder McKinley in Book of Mormon. And I, one of my biggest first experiences post-college, I got a callback to replace Rory O'Malley in Book of Mormon on Broadway. And I was far too young to A, book it, B, prepare in a way that was, I was 21 or 22.
Yeah.
22 maybe. And I remember I prepared, you know, like as much as I thought I needed to. And then the night before the callback, I did not sleep a minute because I kept waking up with just like anxiety pangs. And by the time I showed up, it was like, also it was like a 4 p.m. audition. So I spent the whole day freaking out. Mm-hmm. I had an ex-boyfriend at the time, a boyfriend at the time who was, as I remember it, not helpful. And then I show up to the audition. I was so nervous and not able to just like do what needed to be done. I botched it so bad, and they did not call me in ever again. And I just remember thinking then, like, well, maybe there's a chance, knowing in the back of my head there was no chance. And now that it's been a lot of years later, I'm like, I just wasn't ready at all. And I think when you were doing all of the VJ insanity, I think that you were young enough to like have the energy to do it, but not so young that you didn't crumble at all.
Well, something took over, I think. I don't know what. Thank you for saying that. That's very kind. I definitely was old enough to have had a lot of time in the real world and like a real, you know, having a real job and all that kind of thing. Enough to know that like this was an opportunity I needed to take advantage of, you know, and like push as hard as I could. And so I did, but I also, I guess, was sort of, I don't know. Well, I mean, I wanted the job really bad, but I also kind of thought like the more important thing is to like make connections and maybe, you know, see if I can't find a job here some way or another.
And spoiler alert,
it worked.
She did.
It worked out. It worked out.
Well, speaking of working out, I want to work out my gay ass muscle and ask you the famous gay ass podcast question. Dave Holmes, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Wow. I think it's a tie. It's a photo finish between the Catholic Church and Cher. I think each has their own role to play. You know, I grew up I was a little kid in the 70s and, you know, Cher had a variety show where, you know, it was comedy sketches and medleys and costume changes and
camp,
you
camp,
know,
camp
before we even really knew. Well, before I knew what that was.
But you knew in your gay guts that it spoke to you.
Yes. Yes, I did. Yeah. I needed to have it on. And yeah, there was just something about it that it was just everything. Like sometimes there was, you know, a tender moment, but often it was just, you know, it was just kind of like her doing big broad sketch characters. And then, you know, a reggae medley or whatever.
Right. Well, was that where she did the West Side Story thing and when she played all the
sure
different
was.
Characters?
Yeah. I've also seen Cher in Las Vegas.
Oh.
At Caesar's Palace. Where, yeah, she it was like me and like every 60-year-old gay man who owns a salon in the state of New Mexico. and she changed her clothes 800 times, and every single time the whole crowd lost their shit. And she like came in like a elevator looking like pod thing from the back of the house.
Stop it.
Over the crowd, landed on stage, singing "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For."
Stop it.
And in her little like monologue, she's like, I don't use writers. I don't hire writers. I just have little fun things that I say. And like sometimes when I'm hovering over the crowd in that thing, I dream that it's gonna like fall, and the headline will be, you know, Cher falls, 6 nobodies killed. Those are just my little funny things that I say. I don't have a writer. And it was like, no, we got it.
Oh my God. Cher is, there's a reason. There's a reason.
She is special. And her mother just died.
Which, by the way, Cher is all of how old? 112? Like how old?
Yeah.
And she looks, I think she will look 41 for the rest of her days.
Yes.
How old was her mom?
Gene Hackman. I don't know. Her mom had to have been into her hundreds.
Had to have been. I mean, unless she was a teen mom, which she, I mean, she.
Yeah. Possible.
Wait, so Cher makes complete sense. Is the Catholic connection that you were at Catholic school in St. Louis being told you're going to burn, and that's what made you rebel?
No, No, I think it's just, you know, if you've been to the Catholic Mass, there's a lot of drama. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of robes and scents and traditions and there's song, there's a spoken word interlude, there's everything. It's a show every week. I became an altar boy as fast as I could, and to quote Mark Birbiglia, no. did I say Mark Birbiglia? Mike Birbiglia.
I think you said
no,
Mike.
Didn't happen. So yeah, I mean, it felt there's a lot of pomp to it. There's
a lot of pomp. Does your Mike Birbiglia reference mean that no, it wasn't the experience you wanted, or no, you did not book Altar Boy?
Oh, no, I became an altar boy, and no, I did not get molested.
Thank you for the clarification. Did you did you have any consensual molestations between the other altar boys?
Not at that time, no. No.
The way you say that makes me think that there was...
No, I mean, no, never anything, no.
Did you ever kiss
Not
another...
until...
When was your first boy kiss in St. Louis, or was it after you had left?
It was in St. Louis. It was in St. Louis, yeah.
Do you remember where geographically it was?
Yes, I do. I fooled around with a boy first, but there was no kissing.
Like touching peenies with handsies?
There was, it was, hand and mouth stuff, but no kissing.
Hell yeah. You were, okay.
It was a little like prison sex, I guess, in that
fuck
regard.
Yeah, prison.
Yeah, no, I was like 12 or 13. It was a boy down the street who was a year or two older. We had watched Risky Business on VHS. Mm. I had slept over at his house. We were in the basement, and one thing led to another.
Not kidding. You led the fantasy that I thought I would have for the first 18 years of my life, and I never did. Right. If I may say, I don't think this person listens to this podcast. He is confirmed straight. However, in my high school years, I had a friend who I would do theater with, which would lead anyone to believe that at least a part of him wants to have a mouth on or around his groin,
just for the sense memory.
Exactly. I mean, he's doing Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He wants to I don't know the show well enough to do a blowjob reference, but I will say that I slept over a number of times, and not a single time did any touchies of beanies or peenies or assleenies happened. And it's devastating to me, but the fact that you had a neighborhood boy and you had your own Risky Business, mazel tov.
Sure did. Yeah, it was pretty hot. However, let me say this. After it was over, and I don't know if you'll vibe with this or not. The Catholic in me at that time, after I came, I was immediately so flooded with guilt and shame.
Of course.
And so this was certainly no different. I it was at a sleepover, as I said, and it was going on until the sun came up. And then we finished, and I was like, I have to go home. And so I went home, and I was like, my head was like pounding with shame and guilt. And so much so that I was like, well, this is AIDS. I got AIDS, and I'm going to die probably later this afternoon. And that's what's going to happen. And I was like, at the same time, like, there was a part of me that's like, this is 1984. We don't really know how AIDS works, but that's not it. You don't just like generate it from friction.
And you don't get a pounding headache 3 hours.
It doesn't
later.
Give you a headache. And you would like, it's a longer process.
Sure.
Right? Like, I wouldn't probably die that day. So there was like a tiny part of me that knew that sort of somewhere in my body. But the rest of me was just like so overcome with guilt and shame.
I'm not kidding. I've had to work through that panic and shame for a lot of my life. And I, yeah. a story that's so real and close to your story is that I had not had sex, just like you had only done some fiddling and whittling. And I had my freshman year of college given my first blowjob. I went back to St. Louis for winter break. I had a sore throat. Mm-hmm. I went to get an HIV test because I was convinced I had AIDS.
Yep.
They said at the clinic, when's the last time you had sex? I said, never.
Yeah.
They said,
yeah.
Interesting. Oh, why are you here? I got the test still. And I just, yeah, I just, the there was so much panic. I also like had, I don't know if Jewish and Catholic guilt is like, you know, different sides of the same coin, but I would even like masturbate in the shower and then feel the pain of 3,000 babies going down the drain. I was just like, mm-hmm. I am a monster.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's they really do a number on you.
They really do. Were you able to shed that? How long did it take you to shed that guilt and shame?
No, that's the work of a lifetime.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you think you got a handle on it and then it kind of manifests in a different way, you know? Like I'm still learning, you know? I'm still like finding ways to circumvent it and whatever. And it's, you know, it is the religion element, obviously, but it's also where we grew up. You know, it is, I'm sure pockets like the pocket that we grew up in exist all over the country, all over the world. But where we grew up, our specific sliver of like suburban St. Louis was so homogeneous and so kind of, I don't know if provincial is the word, but like there's one specific way to live. And if you are a tiny, tiny, tiny degree off of that, then you might as well, you know, be at Burning Man.
Exactly.
It instills in you a feeling of like, of doubt about any choice that you might make that isn't in line with what you like grew up.
I'm feeling this in the depths of my chest going into my tummy, because I think sometimes I wonder if I make up some of the feelings of not belonging or the feelings of being different. And then I'll either talk to someone like you or I will visit St. Louis. And of course, you know, it goes without saying that like, there's a reason why I can still visit, because there are still people there that I love and there's still things about it that are fine. But there's so much of it too that's like, oh, they really do not understand a person who has a very, a tiny difference of a life, let alone living somewhere else or being gay, whatever it is. I was with Matt, with my goddamn husband going to Schnucks, of course. And
of course,
the old white man that stared at us buying our produce. I was like, oh my God, I forgot how it feels to be stared at like that. And it's one of the reasons why, as much as I would love to see my family more, and I'm going to, you know, the older I get, the more I really want to make sure I can visit them and see my nephews. But like, I don't think I could live anywhere close to where that sliver is. I do think there are other parts now that are much more progressive. And I went to a farmer's market a couple years ago in Tower Grove Park that was like, oh, wow. Love like, it. I saw gay people. I saw, like, and I was like, okay, this exists and this is healing for me. Yes. But where we grew up, I think it definitely, what you say really rings true.
And it has not changed.
Yeah.
It has not changed. You know, a few years ago, actually probably like 10 years ago, we had a surprise birthday party for my mother. Mm-hmm. And I came in for it. And because it was a surprise birthday party, I couldn't stay with my parents. I couldn't stay with my brothers. Mm-hmm. So I came in a couple days early and I got an Airbnb around Tower Grove Park. And I actually like, I was like, you know, this is going to be a little adventure. And I, in fact, didn't even tell my brothers how early I was coming in. I was just like, I want to be in this city, but not have to talk. I mean, not that it's a burden to talk to my family or friends or whatever, but I was like, I want to act like I'm a tourist.
Yeah.
So I did. And I was in this cute little thing. It was like an old grocery store that got turned into a loft. And it was in this funky area that was like racially diverse and architecturally beautiful. And I was like, oh, I like this place a lot. Like this is a very groovy place. Mm-hmm. and inexpensive and now full of great restaurants because it is so inexpensive. And like it does have a lot going for it, but there is, you know, the pull of that like West County, very conservative world that is everyone I went to high school with and everyone I'm related to. And it's hard to get away from that.
Well, listen, I was in Portland for work this past week and I was stuck because of their biggest ice storm since World War II. And I was there for 48 hours past when I was supposed to be there. And that's a separate insane story. But I bring it up because I saw two friends there that one I went to high school with in St. Louis. And she ended up moving to New York for a while, then moved to L.A. And I got to see her in L.A. And then they moved to Portland. But they revealed to me that they are moving back to St. Louis. And my gut reaction was like, no. Like, I was like, I just like, especially coming from Portland, which the joke I made is that Portland is what Republican Texans think New York is. It's like so purple hair, progressive, queer. Yeah. It's like and of course I love that, but I was like, this is really what it's the most liberal, progressive, queer place I've ever been in my life. Yeah. However, when they said they're moving to St. Louis, I was like, please be careful, like as if they were going to Normandy. But they told me that they were actually going to be doing more of that groovy lifestyle. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you know what? That fucking rules. Like, you can build your own life and just like you and Undercover in a way of going into like that grocery store Airbnb. Like, that, am I close to doing that myself? No, but like that I can envision being pretty fucking cool.
It seems pretty cool. I made the mistake of going on Zillow and looking at
what some of the brownstones
around Lafayette Park are going for. Like, and so now I get these updates like 2-3 times a week about these gorgeous old brownstones that you can get for that. I could buy,
of
you know
course.
What I mean?
Like
home ownership in Los Angeles is not in the cards for me ever. And I work a lot, but it's just like,
Dave,
it's just out of reach for me.
We're looking at houses and it's so impossible. And I, I'm lamenting with you. It's fucked.
It's so fucked. It is crazy, crazy fucked. But yeah, in St. Louis, it's a little easy, but there's obviously a trade-off.
Well, listen, I want to make sure to ask the next podcast question because I could talk about this for literally weeks. But Dave Holmes, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress. Who would you save?
Well, I mean, she's already gone, I'm afraid.
It's okay. You can bring her back.
Can I bring her back and save her? Madeline Kahn. Madeline Kahn.
Classic. I don't know if anyone has brought her back yet, and I'm thrilled that you did.
Okay, good. I just love her. She's another one who I was just like, this is someone, like she's always playing somebody who's like fucking weird and complicated and a little bit glamorous.
Yeah.
And like just on a fucking another planet.
Do you think that Madeline Kahn would have been cast in White Lotus if she was alive?
Oh, God. Damn it. Yes. Yes. Yes, she would. And, you know, as happy as I am for the Jennifer Coolidge moment, I'm just, you know, it's, I don't want us to get sick of her. I don't want it to be
listen.
Bowl of ketchup for dinner. You know what I mean?
It's a very real fear because I have noticed, I've been doing this podcast. This is probably like the 85th episode or something. And Jennifer Coolidge had come up pretty rarely, or you know, every now and again, but all of a sudden in the past month she's come up almost every time.
Yeah.
And that same fear has come up in my brain of like, I can't say any better than you did the ketchup for dinner analogy. I want to make sure we never take for granted what we have.
Exactly. And it's, you know, people are talking about Parker Posey in this way now, and I'm just like, be careful.
I know, I'm one
we
of
don't
people,
we don't so. Want to get Yeah, we don't want to like get tired of Parker Posey. And maybe that's it. Maybe it's like, you know, Madeline Kahn is long gone and I can't get tired of her.
Yeah.
I feel a bit the same way about Terry Garr. You know, she's around, but she doesn't really, you know.
Wait,
you know
Terry
don't see
Garr?
Her. Oh, wow.
You're mad.
Terry Garr is like a very close. You, of course, know Terry Garr.
Oh, I know Terry Garr. Yeah.
She's in... oh my God, she's amazing in After Hours, the Martin Scorsese movie. She has just some of my favorite moments on film ever are Terry Garr. And she, you know, she's not well now, so she doesn't act anymore, but she too is like someone who I just adore.
We love. Her Wikipedia is stunning.
Oh, I bet. I bet. I bet. But yeah, no, Madeline Kahn, only she could give you that reading of that line from Clue.
Flames, you know, flames.
Yeah, yeah. She's great on Sesame Street. She could do it all.
Glad you brought her back because...
Thank you.
She deserves and we deserve. So...
Let's get back to St. Louis.
I do want to ask you another St. Louis question, which is, we have boy, boy, sleepover kissing. What was coming out to, how many brothers do you have?
Two older brothers.
So interesting. You have two older brothers. I have one older, one twin, one younger brother. So we still have the brother connection. So what was the experience like of coming out to St. Louis brothers for you?
It was... tricky. Mm-hmm. It was tricky. Everything was the opposite of what I thought would happen.
Oh.
Everyone who I thought was going to be great was a little bit of a nightmare, and everyone who I thought was going to be a nightmare was great.
That tracks. That tracks. I mean, I thought my at the time 80 something year old grandfather was going to be a nightmare. And he took me to, I don't know if you ever went to Pratzel's, I think that's what it was. Yeah, like a Jewish deli. Which like I'm asking like the Priory boy if he went to a Jewish deli, but I will say, my grandpa said, I'll repeat the story as long as I live. He said, thank you for telling me I don't love you any less. In fact, I think I love you more.
Wow.
And I have to say my 80 something year old grandfather in that sliver of St. Louis, Missouri, that was the last thing I thought he was going to say. And to this day, he's still alive. He's 94 now and always sends his love to Matt and but
that's fantastic.
So I identify with you with because then certain people, you know, well, how old were you when you came out?
I was 22, I guess. I was just about to start my senior year of college, and there was a bit of like it was a bit of a race against the clock because I was sort of out at school.
Uh-huh.
Right. Which I, voluntarily went to a really homogeneous Catholic college.
Where'd you go?
Holy Cross in Massachusetts, which is a great place in a lot of ways. But like I was the gay community there, you know.
Sure.
And I think I went there because like I took a tour of the campus and had a crush on like 11 boys in the first half hour that I was there. And I was like, I for sure made that decision on that basis, which is not kids don't. But I, I was out to a few people there, which I think I even knew meant I was out to everyone there because it was, there was a bit of a grapevine. And I lived in fear of the word getting back home because there were a handful of people from St. Louis and people love to talk there and in St. Louis. So so I kind of felt like they needed to hear it from me. And so as a matter of fact, he denies it, but I think my oldest brother got wind of it before I told anybody.
No.
Which was scary. The whole thing was actually really scary. Like it's hard to like look, my life being the way that it is now and your life being the way that it is now, it is very difficult to look back and remember how fucking scary and raw all of this stuff was.
Yeah, it's truly torture.
Really, like, yeah, I mean, it's a part of your life and your story that you have a perfectly natural desire to keep control over. And it's also like when you do start telling people, that's it, like you can't, it's not like you're trying like Buddhism out for a while or whatever. Like it is, especially for boys and men, it is a thing that you are locked into forever,
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least at the time, it felt that way. And so it's a huge thing. And it's all like, which is very difficult to like negotiate and navigate within. But then it's also really scary because it's like, what if you get beat up? Or like, what if your parents decide not to talk to you?
Exactly. There's very real fear of your own journey of like not being able to turn back of like, if I come out, then this is me getting a tattoo on my body, on my forehead that says I suck dick. But then on the other side of it too is just like you said, in that sliver of St. Louis and all around the country and the world, people feel this way, where you're like, there is a very real fear of, I didn't think I was going to be kicked out of my home, but I was fearful of things being said to me that felt irreversible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
I was worried about, and yes. Here's the thing is that I'm lucky that I came out. I was about 18, I would say. And mm-hmm. All three of my brothers did not beat me up. They did not say anything horrible, but they each responded in ways that showed that they didn't know a single gay person. Mm-hmm. My older brother said to me, who had been in college in Miami, Florida, he said, "Wait, is it the way that you like guys the way that I like girls?" And I was like, in my head, I was like, "You are 20 years old, however, 21 mm-hmm. years old." And I was angry because I said to my mom, I was like, "That really angers me." And she was like, "Well, Eric, you got to give him credit for trying." And I was like, "Do I?" Yeah. But it's just like there was so much, you know, bottled up emotions of like,
yeah,
I've been dealing with it for so long and you don't even know what a gay person is, let alone like how to respond yeah. to someone. So anyways, I want to hear yeah. more about yours.
Yeah. Yeah. So my oldest brother, I think the grapevine reached him and I further think that he told my dad.
Oh, shit.
Because I just got this sense that my father a little bit didn't force the conversation, but was just like, "I get the feeling something's bothering you." And I was like, "I'm way better at hiding this shit than you could ever imagine. So like, you must know something."
She's an actress.
Yeah, for real. And so, yeah, so I guess I told my middle brother first, but even that sort of act, you know what? Here's how it happened. Holy shit. I haven't thought about this in a long time. Mm. I was getting ready to tell my oldest brother at the beginning of the summer. And I chickened out. We went to a baseball game. And I don't know what it was that made me clam up, but I clammed up. And then we went back to his house. He had just bought a house. And his girlfriend, now wife, was there. And he went to bed. And she and I stayed up smoking Marlboro Lights, as we did in those days. And I ended up telling her.
Wow.
And she was super cool about it. And then I think she then mentioned it to my other brother's wife, who mentioned it to him. And I think she also kind of said something to my oldest brother as well. And it was sort of like people kind of knew. By the time...
Talk about a grapevine, Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, you know what it was? She did. She told my other sister-in-law. And then my sister-in-law overheard my brother say something that sounded like the F word, but wasn't. And she was like, "Don't say that." And he was like, why are you so?" And then she told him and whatever. So
that
sort of,
that is a comedy sketch. Hey,
it was so, yeah, it was, except
he said, "Can
not
you grab me that
funny.
Bag?" Yeah. Not
yeah.
Funny, not all funny.
But yeah, so I told my middle brother, he was, you know, he was cool about it. My oldest brother was less so. He was, mm-hmm. You know, he's still very Catholic and whatever. He did, however, he was working for the county prosecutor's office at the time. He was an assistant prosecutor. And his boss was gay. And so he, and you know, his boss is probably my age now. Mm-hmm. And, but my brother was like, "You should have lunch." Like, not, he wasn't trying to like set us up on a date or whatever. He was just like, "You should know another gay person."
That's nice.
Which was nice. Which is really nice.
I mean, that's huge. Part of my struggle was the only gay person I knew in St. Louis really was the guy that would cut my hair.
Yeah.
And no one put us on a lunch date, but
yeah, it was that was a good thing. I think I was too young to really like take advantage of it.
Yeah.
You know, I was very much like, I was very engaged in the activity of trying to show everyone that everything was fine.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think that's partly what probably I've had a delayed maturation in my 30s yeah. because I've realized how much of I convinced myself I was okay when I didn't actually dive into the real feelings.
Yes, of course. Cause you're like, Well, I say you. I should say I. Here's my personal experience, and maybe you will relate to this. Mm-hmm. I felt like I, in coming out, particularly to my family, I couldn't be gay and a second thing. You know, I couldn't be like gay and freaked out about it, or like, or worried about my basic safety, or angry about the way, you know, the sort of milieu that I was raised in and how, you know, how much it sort of fucked me up in this way or whatever. Like I could, or like gay and a little bit like, disappointed with the level of support I was getting or whatever.
Yeah. It's a survival, like, you can't it's be a survival any, you can't tactic.
Be, yes. You like, I felt like I can't be an additional burden. You know what I mean? God. And that's like, that's fucked.
That
you know?
Is so
and,
fucked.
And that's a thing that I'm only like beginning to engage with in middle age. You know what I mean? Is that
I feel
idea,
that
you know?
So deeply. God, that's so well said.
Well,
Dave,
can we please pick this up in 20 minutes? I feel like we're just getting started.
Let's pick it up in 20 minutes.
I have to do a 15-minute interview, and then I'll come right back here.
Do it.
We are a part of that collection of two white men doing podcasts. We're two queer white men. Does that differentiate us at all?
Does it?
Definitely helps with the topic.
We're talking
about musicals.
And we're talking about musical theater.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Nathan.
And yes, musical theater has gospel.
And dancing boys.
And fancy hats.
So join us for the gospel of musical theater wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Part two, Dave Holmes. Listen, yes. When duty calls,
duty gotta
calls.
Do it.
And now
you gotta do it.
You have to do it. I mean, you are the editor at large of Esquire.
Correct. Correct. And sometimes you gotta hop on the phone.
There's so much about our experience. It's weird because we grew up in St. Louis at different times, but
not really.
But not really at all, because as we stated, not much changes. And so, where we were discussing was the responses from the siblings of it all. Mm-hmm. And you were saying something really that struck me hard, which is like, you can't be gay and something else.
Right. Yeah. It's to exist at all is enough of an ask, you know, or like it's already a thing, you know, so you can't also then be like, and this is how I want you to treat me, or this is what respectful treatment looks like, even to yourself, you know?
Yes.
You feel like any reaction other than violence or getting put out on the street or whatever is like good and what you deserve, you know?
And you should feel lucky to have what you have.
Exactly. Exactly.
When I came out, I had these questions that were asked of me that I felt were questions that I didn't need to be the person. Like, I was like, Google it or like ask someone else. I'm dealing with enough on my own. And then in a way for my family, I think to, I'm having a mental battle right now because, you know, I always try to be as respectful as I can to everyone. And my family knows a lot of all of this. So I always feel like I have to give caveats, and I really don't have to, because like we're all good. Everything's good. But the one thing that did happen when I came out is my family has crass sense of humor, which is why I'm partly the way that I am. And I love that about my family. But when I first came out, they would make jokes, I think, in a way to show that they were cool. But sometimes the jokes were like, oh no, you're coming from a suburban Midwestern sensibility of making a joke about gay people. That's not landing in the way that you want it to. And I had to be like, you can't make those jokes. And they respected it and don't. But it was, it was like there were so many landmines to circumvent.
Yeah. Someone I know, like someone in our like family friend group, like the sibling of one of my brother's friends, and someone who was sort of on the like the scene, you know, with my brothers, like the St. Louis kind of social scene a little bit. Like not that they're like, you know, in the Ledoux news all the time, although sometimes they are. Like that kind of that world. Anyway, someone in that world who was married and had a couple kids came out, right? In his 40s. This is a while back. And like still when that person's name comes up, like there's a little bit of like somebody might go, hello, like that. Like it's there's still the feeling of like jokey joke around that person.
I was gonna say
still,
yeah, that's a jokey joke.
And like as though this person has been just reduced to being like the butt of a joke, and like that that can happen around me, and like I want to be cool about it, but it's also like that, you know, that's a person, that's, you know, that's not a. He exists beyond the stereotype or the need for a joke or whatever. And you probably wouldn't do that to his face. So don't do that. But like, anyway, it's.
Well, I think that what you say there is the exact example of coming out in a place like that almost becomes the only thing you're allowed to be is the gay guy that came out
exactly.
After being married or like that. So like,
right.
So that has happened in my current life where. I will hear about someone who has come out later in St. Louis and, you know, there's just talk about what a big deal it was. And it seems less of like the big deal being that they're honoring their truth and more the big deal of just like they told someone or that they were like there. And there's still that feeling of shame, which of course I have to be like, interesting. Like the story around this is still the shame. And like, I have to still grapple with the fact that I don't want to need to feel shame, but I'm being told subconsciously that I sort of do. And then that also makes me think of, you know, Matt and I were in Palm Springs for his birthday a few weeks ago. And the more scenarios that I find myself in like that, where I'm like, just hanging out with gay men of various ages, the more and more I'm meeting men who have children from a previous marriage or relationship with a woman and then who have come out. And it's just been so interesting to like not only compare their stories, but also think about like that was the world where there's so many, and it's always going to be this way, but especially in my parents' generation for sure, of just like the guys who did what they thought they needed to do.
Right.
And then came out and here I am flirting with a daddy and a dad at the pool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the desire to not have to do that that keeps men in the closet, like even to themselves, like you are just like for so long, I was just like, well, this is just a thing that I'll get over. you know, and then everything will be normal and I won't have to worry about like bringing shame to my family or whatever. And it's like, that's dumb. And ultimately, like I was just more horny than that feeling is like the only reason that I sort of came out earlier than some.
Same.
You know what I mean? And like,
horniness transcends social rules.
For sure.
Horniness transcends.
Horniness honestly rules. Partially horniness and also partially like thinking that I would meet a boy who would make it make sense to my family, but probably also to me. You know what I mean? Mm. And like someone would come in and just like solve it for me and meet this like, you know, boy from Country Day or something. You know what I mean? Or whatever.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine? I'm sure it happens.
Who was the first boy? Who was the first boy that you brought to meet your family?
My New York boyfriend, my like immediately post-college New York boyfriend, who I met because he was dating a female friend of mine.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
He was dating a female friend, and then would you flirt while they were dating?
When I first met him, I was like,
hello. I'm kidding.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just sort of, I got a vibe, and then I say dating, like they had gone out like twice, but she brought him around, and he and I met, and he lived like a block away from me. And we hung out one night and he was like, can I kiss you? And I was like, yeah. And then we dated for like 3 or 4 years. So that friendship is torched forever. I probably could have handled that situation a little different, but whatever. So that guy. And he very much fit the bill. He was like mainline Philadelphia preppy boy. Mm. Still very much is. Mm. And they liked him a lot.
Is it weird? Was it weird seeing your boyfriend with your straight brothers interact?
A little bit, but honestly, even in like 3 or 4 years, that didn't happen a ton. I brought him home once, and it was fine. It was good, but I also, in retrospect, so much was riding on it. You know what I mean? I really felt like that was like the way to make it okay was to have the kind of perfect boy or whatever.
Look, I'm in a successful...
He was great. Ultimately, we were not right for each other.
Yeah. So then how did you meet your current gorgeous, amazing, talented musician partner?
Oh, he is lovely. We met at a bar in Venice, California, on Abbot Kinney, the other room. My roommate from New York was in town or had been in town and for my birthday weekend. And then he had just left. And I think I dropped him off at the airport, and then I met some friends at the other room, and it was the night after my birthday, and we just struck up a conversation, and here we are, 18 years later.
Did who got the other person's number?
I got his.
Did you kiss that night?
No.
Wow, look at that. No.
Yeah, we held on.
Did any of your preppy upbringing, did it influence your taste in men? And how has your taste in men changed as you've gotten older?
It absolutely did. It absolutely did.
Well, what were you into? I want to see if we have a similar thing.
Okay, I'm trying to think who... You know what's funny? It's a bad transfer, but it's on YouTube. The pilot episode of Moonlight, we just watched last night, and it's so good. But like Bruce Willis, that sort of like very, very confident, like wisecracking, bro-y guy. Like that was that.
I'm sure when I watched Sixth Sense, I felt things about him.
Sure. Probably. Yeah. Probably even still. Yeah. But yeah, it was like, it was a Huey Lewis. It was a Corey Hart. It was a sort of daddy-ish type with friendly eyes.
That is so it. Daddy type with friendly eyes. I've said this before, and I'll say it to you. My grandfather owned Williams Pharmacy on Forest Park Parkway. It was very close to WashU. It was So my uncle and my dad then owned a pharmacy called Prescription Plus, which was in the Central West End. It was this like small pharmacy that was like upstairs, and I would go as a young kid, and they would sell Beanie Babies, and I would like hang out with the Beanie Babies, fine. And I would start to have dreams as like an 8-year-old about the businessmen who would go into this pharmacy. And in my dreams, I would climb up their bodies like a tree and make out with their faces and grab their stubble and like probably look into their kind eyes. And that was like my earliest guy memory as a literal child. I think I cried and told my mom about it because I was so young and naive to know what was going on.
Wow. But yeah, no, I get that. I get that for sure.
I still have a daddy thing, I'll be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too. Like my oldest brother, my brothers are like 8 and 10 years older. Mm-hmm. So like their friends definitely kind of set the type as well. Yeah. My oldest brother had a close friend who was just like, had like kind of sleepy friendly eyes and just like a cool vibe about him and whatever. Yeah. I was very attracted like in high school and college to just like, more than a look, like a walk. Oh. Like a sort of a broad chested, you know, shoulders back kind of like that vibe of just like extreme confidence.
BDE, as one might say.
Sure, one might say that. That definitely, that got me. In high school, I had a devastating crush on one of my good friends.
Oh, same.
He had dark hair and blue eyes and was this incredible football player.
Hairy chest?
No.
And
no.
Why would I ask?
Yeah, no. I mean,
happy trail?
No. Maybe kind of, yeah.
All right, I'll stop.
No, pretty like, and I have no strong position on body hair, pro or con. Okay. I guess I'd probably lean pro. He was super smooth. But just like he had this kind of low key swagger about him that was like absolutely intoxicating. Mm. And it was so like in high school, if you were paying any attention at all, you could tell that I was just so fucking like so in love with this guy. Oh. And nothing ever happened. He, get this. This is lovely. We sort of lost touch. After, you know, a few years after college. And then in 2016, my book came out. And I knew that he lived in D.C. And I did a reading in D.C. And he showed up. And I hadn't told him about it. I hadn't seen him in forever. And I was like, oh, this is so nice. And you should have warned me because I'm not ready. And he looked fucking great. And his wife got off work shortly thereafter and she came and met us and a bunch of us went out for drinks and whatever. And we all like hung out and I got to know his wife a little bit and she and I clicked. She was pregnant at the time and, that baby was born, I guess that late summer. And I am that kid's godfather.
You're kidding me.
No. And it's like, you know, which was so nice, especially since, you know, there's like a good chapter or two in the book about, like, I changed his name, but like you can fucking totally tell it's him, about like how like out of my mind in love I was with this guy.
Do you think he read the book?
Well, it had not come out. I mean, it had just, okay. I guess if it came out on a Tuesday, this reading was a Thursday.
Okay, so he had not read it yet.
He had probably not read it. And I was like, and as with coming out to my family, I was like, I should just give him a little heads up that his beautiful eyes are a big part of the
book. There are 39 pages just about your eyes.
Yeah. And I never did. And then the next day I was on the train, like, just by the way, like there's some whatever. And it, you know, he comes off well in the book because he was, you know, a gentleman in real life to someone who was so clearly in love with him. And, you know, like I look back at that and I'm like, I hate that what I think is like, that must have cost him something. You know what I mean? Like to have been, you know, in a small all boys Catholic environment that's very conservative and very homogeneous, to continue to be a loyal friend to someone who is pretty clearly the gay kid and also pretty clearly like super into you, is that did not come without a cost to his social standing, I'm sure. You know what I mean?
I don't know. It's such a good question because that's a very empathetic position you're taking, because when I think about him, he's a football player, he's gorgeous, he is confident. In a way, I'm like, was he untouchable? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
But I don't know. But maybe there was a cost. I don't know. But like, I see. He sounds like a great version of the type of person you would want to fall in love with as a closet case, because mine was not as gracious when I came out to him. He asked something that really pissed me off then, and he said to me, and I had clearly been in love with him. Let's make that clear. Yeah. I told him I was gay, and he said, So, have you ever been into me? And I was like, you know the answer, and I know that the answer, that you're very straight, and this is coming from like a narcissistic place. And it really didn't sit well with me, because I was like, at least wait a day.
Yeah.
Or let's settle in for a second, and like, let's, this is kind of about me right now, babe. Like, it was like,
yeah.
And I wish that, I mean, there, no, I feel like your friendship story is like the best case scenario, because in a lot of ways, no one can win when there's the closet case gay kid in love with his straight guy friend. That's hard. It's hard for the ending to be a happy one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is, you know, he's,
that is a story.
It's, yeah. I mean, you know, and it's, it is like a nice, it's a nice like version of it, you know?
I'm
lucky for that.
Can I ask you like a really, I'm going to pretend I work for a pop culture a magazine that doesn't have a lot of morals.
Great.
Dave Holmes, have you ever had a flirtation or more with a person that I would recognize that would be a surprise to me?
No.
Have you had a crush on anyone that was very surreal to be in the room with them?
Huey Lewis recently. I did a feature on him for Esquire a couple years ago. Got to go to his ranch in Montana.
Hell yeah.
And hang out for the day. He was lovely. He's like, he's, you know, he's definitely old now, you know, and he's aging in a natural way, and it fucking works. He looks so good.
How old is he?
He's like 70.
Hell yeah.
Early 70s. Hell yeah. Yeah, he looks fantastic. No, you know what? I never really hung out with like famous people. Mm-hmm. Certainly not enough to like get a vibe.
Sure.
Or like start a thing or whatever. Yeah, no. Because really like the famous people who I was suddenly surrounded with when I got to MTV, like a few months after I got there, became very young people. Like it started as, you know, actors and like rock bands, guys in their 20s. And then it was pop groups in their like teens. And so I was not somebody who was like trying to be friends with, children. You know what I mean?
With O-Town.
With O-Town. Exactly. Yeah, no, also, and also I just never like at that time in my life, my self-esteem was so fragile that like, I would never have like, I would never have even tried to flirt with anybody.
That's partly why I think that I did not have as much of a slutty phase in my 20s as I could have.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I don't deserve to fuck a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I sure did have that phase in my 20s because, you know, because I was living in New York.
Yeah.
And like, you know, at the time, in a pre-grinder time, where with, you know, real life cruising and stuff, like you could, you know, if you knew the sort of subtle body language to employ, you could do a good amount of hooking up.
Palm Springs, a guy I was talking to who was there with his partner. He had many children with his ex-wife, and he met his current partner in a cruising forest on the East Coast, like where people park their cars, and they hooked up there, and now they've been together like 4 years.
I love it. You know, that existed in Forest Park.
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There was a certain area I forget the name of the street. It's not, I mean, I guess, you know, Grindr has made it redundant or whatever, but yeah, there was definitely that area in Forest Park.
It's right by the boathouse, I'm sure.
It's not. It's closer to Skinker.
Skinker.
It's not too far off the main drag. But yeah, after the bar's closed.
You go it off of Skinker.
You do what you got to do in those days.
Listen.
You know, no regrets.
Just love. We can dance. What song am I singing? Until we die, know. You and I will be young forever.
Teenage Dream.
Thank you. Dave, yeah. I can't take any more of your time. I want to...
This has been a ball.
It's been such a ball and such a pleasure. And before we say goodbye, I have to ask you the final podcast question, which is, Dave Holmes.
Yes.
What is the best Whoopi Goldberg film?
Oh, God. What is the best Whoopi Goldberg film? I should have an answer. She is not in Fried Green Tomatoes, which I finally just watched. I don't know why that popped into my head. If she were in that, it would be that. But she's not. Soap Dish, I guess.
Really good answer. Great.
Soap Dish.
And I watched that movie probably 2 years ago for the first time. And
yeah,
huge fan. Great answer. Dave, everybody should be listening to Home Affiliate Podcast. Everybody should be reading your gorgeous book. Everybody should be following you. Where can people follow you on the internet?
I am just, I am on Twitter for the time being, at Dave Holmes until it becomes unsustainable, which could happen today. But I'm also on Instagram at Dave Holmes.
We love
it. And then I'm on Post and, you know, Mastodon and all those other things, but they haven't really fully taken off for me yet.
And your Twitter is honestly Twitter, one Instagram. Of the reasons why I've stayed on, because your Twitter is actually like not toxic and it's funny and it's great and everybody should follow
you.
And, Dave, thank you for coming on this podcast. Okay. I could talk to you for hours and I hope to see you again soon. I really do.
You will.
Done. Gorgeous person, gorgeous episode, and gorgeous audience. Thanks for trekking along for this whole extra special extended episode. And be sure to leave that 5-star review and subscribe if you don't yet. I'm going to be guesting on some really fun podcasts with people I love who have been on this podcast. So stay tuned for those announcements. And I'll be booking the next live show in LA soon. And I'm just grateful to you. I love you. Have a great, great rest of your week.
We are a part of that collection of two white men doing podcasts. We're two queer white men. Does that differentiate us at all?
Does it?
Definitely helps with the topic.
We're talking about
musicals.
And we're talking about musical theater.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Nathan.
And yes, musical theater has gospel.
And dancing boys.
And fancy hats.
So join us for the gospel of musical theater wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.